Jesus never stops being Jesus. Jesus knows this moment is coming. He's prepared for it. And he stays grounded in his purpose throughout this terrorizing story. Jesus stops Peter. He later tells Pilate that if Jesus acted like the Romans acted, all his followers would be fighting. But, he says, my kingdom is not of this world. Put your sword away, he says to Peter. Attacking the wrong person is not how we win.
Welcome to another episode of Sermon Podcast Hour with the Collective Table. It's me, Talib, and today I'm joining Chelsea as we sit down to chat with Reverend Anne Dunlap.
This week, Talib and I sit down with activist, teacher, and herbal warrior, Reverend Anne Dunlap. She is an ordained minister in the United Church of Christ as a community minister for racial justice and solidarity. Reverend Dunlap has been named by her friends as the fierce good reverend of the revolution. She also coordinates faith work for Showing Up for Racial Justice, or SURGE. You can check out their podcast, The Word is Resistance. Reverend Dunlap believes in the power of solidarity, community, and fierce love in the work of disrupting and dismantling white supremacy and living each day more fully into the beloved community. She endeavors to live as a commitment to fierce love and collective liberation in all that she does.
We're so glad you're joining us for this dynamic, inspirational, important conversation. If you like what you hear, be sure to share it with a friend, give us a like or rating. You can also find The Collective Table on Instagram, Facebook, and our website at thecollectivetable.org.
To kick it off, we wanted to play you a longer clip from Reverend Dunlap's podcast sermon. If you'd like to listen to the whole episode, check out the show notes or visit our website.
For me, making sure that Malchus is named makes this point even stronger. Making sure that Peter is named makes this point even stronger. Put your sword away, Jesus says, to the leader who will carry on in his name. And it's not a conversation about nonviolence or self-defense in the face of oppression. It's about knowing who your adversary is. And that is not Malchus. It's another reminder not to forget who we're supposed to be organizing against. Which brings me to the third signpost of clarity. Jesus never stops being Jesus. Jesus knows this moment is coming. He's prepared for it. And he stays grounded in his purpose throughout this terrorizing story. Jesus stops Peter. He later tells Pilate that if Jesus acted like the Romans acted, all his followers would be fighting. But, he says, my kingdom is not of this world. Put your sword away, he says to Peter. Attacking the wrong person is not how we win. Jesus is clear about who the adversary is and how they behave. He refuses to be manipulated by Pilate because he knows it's a rigged game. And he never turns on his people. Through multiple interrogations and beatings, he never gives up info about who they are, never betrays them. What he does is insist on community. Insist that Peter recognize Malchus, for example. And assure, Jesus assures that his beloveds are cared for before he dies, creating new forms of relationship, new forms of family. With his last breaths.
This sermon podcast comes from Surge's podcast called The Word is Resistance. It's a great podcast that is produced by white anti-racist Christians based on the Christian lectionary year. It offers an anti-racist word for other white Christians. This episode is part of a larger Lenten series called Signpost in the Wilderness. This particular episode is a Good Friday sermon in which Reverend Dunlap discovers three signposts for the work of white anti-racist Christians in the long and terrifying story of Jesus' arrest and execution by Roman authorities. It's found in the Gospel of John. This episode begs us to ask the question, what can we learn from each other? From our mistakes and misconceptions, from our places of pain and also our places of joy. We hope you enjoy this conversation as much as we did. Reverend Ann Dunlap, thank you so much for joining us. We are so thrilled to have you on the podcast. So thrilled to lift up your work and the podcast that you have, The Word is Resistance. I'm wondering if you could just share a little bit about the Word is Resistance comes from showing up for a racial justice surge, has a faith kind of component, and this podcast comes out of there. So I'm wondering if you could just tell us a little bit about Surge and a little bit about The Word is Resistance.
Sure. And I'm just so happy to be here. Thank you so much, Chelsea and Tlaib, for having me with you today. Yeah, The Word is Resistance is a project of Surge Faith, and Surge, or Showing Up for Racial Justice, is a national network that began in 2009. And our mission is really to organize white people into the work for racial and economic justice, into that broader movement. And so we started this podcast in January of 2017. Our first episode was Martin Luther King weekend, right before the inauguration of the previous president, which was quite the time to start a podcast that's really about speaking to and engaging with white Christians, other white Christians, to bring an anti-racist word or interpretation to our sacred scripture. I mean, what a time to do that. We engage with the lectionary. That's how we decided to go about it. So we have a contributor crew that mostly we do individual episodes, but sometimes we talk to each other. The series that this episode we're going to talk about today comes out of a series that we did where a lot of the episodes were us talking to each other about this work together. So
this particular episode is a sermon you did, a Good Friday sermon of Lent 2021, which is another huge time for white Christians. I mean, it seems like they're all the time at this point, but really to be involved in anti-racist movement. I mean, you open talking about this is the week of the trial of Derek Chauvin. And so the parallels that you kind of make throughout the sermon, talking about that trial and the trial of Jesus, it really kind of speaks directly to white Christians. Where are white Christians showing up currently today?
As I sit down to work on this Good Friday episode, Derek Chauvin's trial has started. The cop who murdered George Floyd. The trial has only just begun, but we already know that Floyd is being blamed for his own death in that courtroom. And we know that the trial, even if it miraculously finds Chauvin guilty of the murder he committed, it won't bring justice for George and his family. Not until we transform the conditions that allow cops to kill with impunity on behalf of the state will there be justice. Jesus goes on trial this week. A very different kind of trial, since Jesus was not a state-sanctioned murderer. But I wonder, too, to what extent both trials are shams. To what extent both trials mock us with the question, what is truth? To what extent crucifixion will be excused? To what extent the powerful will wash their hands of it all once the trial is over? It's Holy Week. The parallels are stark.
You know, I have to share with you, I have read and listened to this sermon 5 or 6 times. And every time I read or listen to it, I am feverishly taking notes because something new comes. There's just, it's so jammed-packed with nuggets and things that just really caused me to deeply think about where am I as a white Christian faith leader, where am I showing up? How am I participating or not participating in some of this work? So we'll make sure to put the link so people can listen to it in full and find your other wonderful podcasts and sermons. But for this particular one, what was your hope in preaching it? What did you hope your listeners walked away feeling, doing, questioning?
The first thing is I always want white Christians who are checking out our podcast to come away with some feeling of like, I have something to contribute to this movement. I have something to contribute to this work. And I have understood something new about my own stake in getting free from these systems that are so oppressive to actually all of us, that there's actually something at stake for us. And in this particular episode, I mean, it was such such a fraught time in the spring. It's Good Friday. I mean, Holy Week. There's the heaviness of that grief. It was Derek Chauvin's trial had just started that week, and of course, you know, we were just starting to feel like, you know, the vaccinations for COVID were happening. But still, in this really aftermath of the previous presidency and the attack on the Capitol and his impeachment, you know, another impeachment trial, just like so much. There's just so much that we're all trying to hold right now. And so, you know, just whatever folks are bringing to that space with me, I want them to just, like, anything that you feel about that, if it's grief, you know, I want to really honor that grief. Both of the story of you know, this beloved teacher of ours, Jesus, and his execution, the grief of that, like, honor the grief of that, honor the grief of this current reality, like the stress of this moment, the trauma of this moment that we're living through. And calling white folks into deeper work in the movement. And I would also, you know, I'm one of the things I'm always trying to do on the podcast is really push back on anti-Semitic and anti-Jewish readings of these stories. And not only to just push back on them, but to provide an alternative. Like, okay, so if it's not about anti-Semitism, if it's not about, you know, well, the claiming that that Jewish people killed Jesus, like, then what actually is it? What is the new meaning that we can find in these stories? Because I have found that, you know, the common thing we do in more progressive spaces is like, well, we'll change the Jews in the Gospel of John. I'm using quotes. You can't see me do that, but I am. The Jews, quote unquote. We'll change it to religious authorities because we're trying to make it better, which is a great impulse. But that doesn't actually help us to understand the power dynamics that are happening. So it's also like trying, and of course, historically, Holy Week and Good Friday are fraught with anti-Semitic, anti-Jewish readings of the stories, reenactments of the stories. And so I also like was holding that commitment. Like, how do we, what is the different story that we could tell from here? And so, you know, bringing a different power analysis of the text and how that impacts our organizing together, our work together for collective liberation, how we get free, how we get out of these systems that are so violent.
That's really helpful. Just the shifting of the lens. I think in Christian spaces, we so often, especially progressive Christian spaces, we like to tell people, oh, that conservative or literal reading you view, that's not right. But then we don't ever provide them with a new way.
Right, right, yeah. Right.
And then we leave people just like, well, then what do I hold on to or what is true? And so that lens shift is really helpful.
What is truth? That's the question of Pilate in the readings for this episode. So, yeah.
Well, it's very compassionate too. It's bringing in everyone into the conversation. And I think that's wonderful. I think that's so difficult. It is very difficult to not be equipped. Even I was explaining to Chelsea, it's so interesting to me because I'm passing white, you know, and so I have to, I was listening to this and it was confronting, I was confronting a lot of certain questions and things. And so being able to hear how you're unpacking it and it was very meaningful to me. So I'll say thank you, but it was very meaningful.
One thing you just named in the question you were answering, which always happens, then five more questions come out. But you were talking about that time and I forgot about COVID and I forgot about the COVID vaccines when you said that. I was like, that's right. That was that time. And there is this sense, I think because we're so, you know, we have such a virtual world now that we're so aware of so much more than we were 5, 10, 15, you know, years ago. And there is this thing that, you know, compassion fatigue, where we really feel this overwhelming sense of where the world is. And I think a lot of times the tendency is to shut it off as opposed to lean in or engage somehow. And there's boundaries in that for sure. But I also think I always name the things that Christians are doing wrong. That's just my tendency. I really like being a Christian, but we don't always give space for lament and grief and stress and overwhelmingness. And you took on Holy Week,
Good Friday and specifically, which is really, like you named, a heavy time, no matter when you're reading that story, in the midst of all this other stuff. And you named it in your sermon. You know, you say there's things that we can feel the stress of this. We can feel the weight of this. That's not, they have things to teach us too. And I think we need to kind of give people space for that, to say, like, this is really difficult.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I don't really know how to move in it.
Yeah. And I think you named something really important, which is there is so much that we're aware of now that we weren't aware of because of social media, because of 24-hour news cycles. And so much comes at us all the time. And both, yes, like the need to lean into it, but I think also to have a lot of care with that, because our nervous systems did not evolve to hold all of the disasters of the planet at once, which is kind of what we're asked to hold. Like, our nervous systems can't do that. We're not built for that. Maybe we're evolving to that. I don't know if that's the best thing. Like, I don't know, but our nervous systems actually, we can't hold that much. You know, our nervous systems evolved to care about, you know, how far the community extending how far we could walk in a day on our daily hunt, and were we going to get eaten by a tiger? And that's not the reality that we live now. And so to also just have so much compassion, not the kind of checking out that white folks do of like, this doesn't concern me, but also some protectiveness around, like, I actually cannot hold one more thing in my heart today. And that being okay, you know, that being okay.
And it is that tension of how do I engage and yet put up boundaries? And there's a, you know, where the compassion fatigue comes from a lot, I think.
So then we have a lot of, coming back to the Holy Week and Good Friday stories, we can have a lot of compassion for the disciples who were usually like mad at because they aren't there. Like, maybe they weren't there for a good reason, actually. You know, maybe that was the best choice for them in that moment to be somewhere else and not watch their friend be assassinated, you know. Sometimes that's the right choice.
Wow. I never thought of that before. Well, I love this idea of signpost. You got that from Reverend Vincent Harding?
Dr. Vincent Harding. Mm-hmm.
The late Dr. Vincent Harding, elder and leader in the Black Freedom Movement, often spoke of live human signposts. People in our lives who can help us find the way towards greater wholeness and multiracial democracy.
How does this idea of the signpost, how does that fit into your overall sermon? How did it help you kind of unpack the sermon?
Yeah, so the signpost, I actually knew Dr. Harding when we lived in Denver. He was a really beloved mentor. And the signpost, that was something that he talked about. That was a story he shared a lot, actually. And you can hear it in his interview with Krista Tippett on the On Being series that she does. I listen to it like every 6 months. But our podcast contributor, Margaret Ernst, actually brought that idea to us for Lent. Like, where are the signposts for us as white Christians in this moment? Where are the people or the ideas that can actually guide us towards this place of greater wholeness, this place of multiracial democracy? And so all of Lent, including this episode, were like sitting with those questions. And so I, you know, as I was studying the text, I was asking myself, and I was asking Dr. Harding, you know, okay, where are the signposts here? What are the things that I need to be paying attention to that are going to illuminate something important for us, something new for us? And that, you know, really became key to how I then began to understand this story, actually in a new way for me too. I mean, you mentioned that earlier, like a bunch of new stuff. There was new things for me.
You know, I was thinking about how you talked about feeling this in our bodies, reading the scripture, and the sort of space that we have to hold for that, and how it can actually, reading it out loud, how important that is. And so where did that come from? How did you sort of, that's an encouragement to me. And I'm curious of how you sort of came into that.
Yeah. You know, on the podcast, we're always trying to encourage folks to be in touch with what's happening in their bodies because of the way that white supremacy tries to disconnect us from our bodies, from our emotions, from our feelings. It's a way to try to convince us that what we see and feel is not the truth, right? And so it tries to disconnect us from that wisdom that our bodies hold. And so we want folks to feel, we want them to connect with their bodies. And I tell this story on the episode of reading John 18 and 19 out loud on Good Friday in the church where I was interning and feeling how different an experience that was and how all of a sudden I, because of how it felt in my body, understood Pilate to actually be super manipulative in this whole story, for example. But that really began for me when I was 17 and I went on a mission trip to the border, Reynosa, Mexico, across the border from McAllen, Texas. And we were doing like hard labor. We were building floors for a community center and we built a sidewalk and ramp at someone's house for someone who used a wheelchair and didn't have actually a way to get in and out of her house. And, you know, we had been working for several days and I was like tired in my body, you know, because we pounding cement and mixing cement and hauling it in wheelbarrows and all this stuff. And our last night down there, one of the leaders read out loud Matthew 25, you know, if you do this for the least of these, you do it for me. And I can still remember like I felt that you did this for them. And I felt it, that like the aching in my muscles and in my bones and the tiredness and, you know, remembering like the memory of hauling a wheelbarrow. Like I felt the labor that we had done in those days. And feeling that helped me to understand that text really for the first time. It's like, oh, this is about what we do, like what we do with our bodies, like that matters. And so I think ever since then, for me, engaging with these stories in our sacred text has been an embodied experience, you know, whether it's excitement over what I'm reading or puzzlement or confusion, like what is my belly doing right now while I'm reading Paul and I'm completely confused about what in the world he thinks he's talking about. Like those are clues to help me go deeper into the interpretation of these stories, you know? And so I want that for other folks, not just for reading the Bible, but for all kinds of things. Like what clues are our bodies giving us about what we're experiencing?
Something you just said, white supremacy tries to disconnect us from our bodies. I'm wondering if you can just kind of unpack that a little bit more, because I think sometimes we think white supremacy is like marching down Charlottesville with like flames in our hand or storming the Capitol. But what do you mean when you say white supremacy? What does that mean for you?
I'm going to try to paraphrase Petita Martinez's definition of white supremacy, which really I should know by heart because I use it all the time. But white supremacy is a system of exploitation to protect the wealth and power of very few people. It exploits land and labor and bodies, both people of color, Black folks, Indigenous folks, other people of color, but also white labor. And so it's a system of power and it's embedded into the structures and institutions in which we live. So yes, it is, you know, the folks marching down the streets of Charlottesville or wherever with their tiki torches, but it's also like embedded into the daily lived world that we live in. And it requires certain things. And one of the things it requires of white people is to not believe what our bodies are telling us. When we see, you know, police violence against Black bodies, when we see George Floyd be murdered in the street, it's trying to teach us not to believe what we see and what we feel, like that is actually wrong. It's going to tell us, no, it's not wrong. He must have been a threat. He must have done something. He must have been in the wrong place. He must have had drugs in his system. And these are all things that the Chauvin's defense lawyer said, right? Trying to convince us to not believe what we actually know in our bellies and in our hearts and what we see with our own eyes. So that's what I mean, that when I say that white supremacy tries to disconnect us from our bodies, even those of us who are white. We're often, one of the ways that things get framed is like we have white privilege, which is not language that I prefer to use anymore, because I don't think it helps us to really understand the power that is at play or the ways in which white supremacy is actually harmful to everyone within this structure, what it asks us to sacrifice and give up without even really knowing it, because it's kind of insidious in that way.
And it's nothing new. We see it in this sermon and we see it in this story.
Mm-hmm.
And the first signpost you talk about, when you talk about three signposts, and the first is collaborators. I'm wondering if you could just, you know, kind of walk us through that.
The first signpost I talk about is collaborators. And one of the things that we are not taught about Christianity, what we are not taught about what is happening in first century Palestine, so the community in which Jesus is living and doing his teaching, is that the Roman Empire has colonized this land and it has appointed the chief priests, some of the scribes, some of the members of the Sanhedrin, which is the Jewish council that kind of oversees things. And of course, Herod is essentially just a Roman puppet, even though supposedly he's Jewish. What we're taught is, you know, Christianity is great and Judaism is less so. Even in more progressive circles, that's kind of the message we get. Just as a blanket, it all gets flattened into this. We're not taught that Rome has actually appointed these particular sets of leaders, and their job is to serve Rome's interest, which is to increase the power and wealth. And you'll notice I just said the same language that I said for white supremacy, to increase the power and wealth of the dominant class of the Roman Empire. And they did that by taxing goods, harvests, income. They did that through all kinds of repressive tactics. And so they were collaborating with Rome. That is a very small group of people, actually, who were doing that. And so once we begin to understand that and we begin to like get our power analysis correct, is what I've been saying lately, like we get the correct power analysis, Rome is actually in charge here and the folks who are collaborating with Rome. And so who John is, the Gospel of John, the author of the Gospel of John, is angry at is with those collaborators. It's not like this blanket condemnation of Judaism as if it's somehow lacking, but, you know, like really seriously angry with the folks who collaborated, not only in the execution of their friend, but also the suffering of their people and of their community. And once we kind of get that figured out, then a whole bunch of more stuff, you know, becomes more clear.
Yeah, you say it's the great trick that Christianity pulled as it became the dominant force of the Roman Empire. It was Rome they needed to be organized against. And you make a point in your sermon to talk about how, and this happens today, we like to think that these things were so archaic and they just have new ways of manifesting themselves. But instead, what we do is we all fight with each other and we are distracted by that. And so the great manipulation is able to continue because we think we need to be mad at each other. And that's how the rich stay rich and the powerful stay powerful. And we're all distracted.
And it's that deflection, you know, that the powerful use, like, oh no, we're not to blame. You know, these people over here are to blame, which is really one of the primary ways that anti-Semitism functions. It functions to deflect attention away from those who actually hold the structural power. And so instead of blaming Rome for Jesus's death, Christianity blames the Jewish people or Judaism as a religion for Jesus's death. And so we got to ask ourselves, like, who does that actually benefit? Like, why would they spin the story in that way? And more recently, we can see that deflection, for example, with the current conspiracy theory that the immigrant caravans are funded by George Soros. So we do that. Oh, they're being funded by this billionaire Jewish guy, rather than actually dealing with the fact that global racial capitalism, which is run by white, wealthy, predominantly Christian men, creates political and economic conditions from which people have to flee. So instead of actually addressing that, we've deflected the attention away to something else, right? And that conspiracy theory then is what the white men who murdered people at the Walmart in El Paso, the Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh, the Chabad Synagogue in Poway, and in those massacres targeting both Jews and those perceived to be immigrants, may their memories be a blessing. So all of those white men mentioned variations of that conspiracy as their reasons for their actions. So that's one of the ways that that deflection is working. But it also is like in all kinds of smaller ways, not quite so, you know, bloodily violent, but violent in their own ways. But that deflection too, I think, you know, and I talk about this in this episode more broadly, is like one of the common deflections that happens in this country is to blame like the South, right? Or poor and working class white people for the difficulties in achieving like actual true collective liberation, or to be able to achieve anything at all right now that benefits people as a whole. We saw that in the 2016 election, the 2020 election, fallout, you know, from the attack on the Capitol, all of the recent legislation, you know, for voter suppression, anti-trans bills, anti-abortion bills. It's so easy to just blame the South or Southerners or poor and working class white folk, like we're just backwards or something, rather than taking a hard look at how a small group of powerful white Christian men have gerrymandered the system to keep a stranglehold on power.
We blame, quote unquote, the South, rather than the whole power structure of white supremacy and a small group of white Christian men who hold an outsized amount of power. We blame and disinvest from poor and working class white communities, cutting off the ears of those living under oppression. We forget our purpose and end up collaborating with Rome.
If you look at the polling in Texas, the majority, like a strong majority of people in Texas, don't want the voter suppression bills. They don't want the anti-abortion bill that just went through. They don't want these things, but the power structure has gerrymandered itself to be able to hold on to power in that way. And so when we do that kind of blaming of the South and of poor and working class white folks, it keeps us from actually looking at the power structure. You know, it erases the brilliant Black and people of color-led organizing in the South that has actually led to some substantial victories. It ignores how Northern institutions have disinvested and continue to disinvest from the South and from poor and working class white communities. And like blaming the whole South allows the rest of the country to just wash its hands of responsibility for racism and posture itself as if it's better. And that posturing, it doesn't actually help anything. It just keeps folks divided who actually might make common cause against the powerful. And this is actually a serious problem for white folks in particular, because we love to be the good ones. We love to posture ourselves as the good ones and as the innocent ones. And Nicola Torbett, who's one of our contributors on the podcast, says that, you know, that this posturing that we do as white people prevents us from building relationship with other white folks that we are taught to be afraid of. And that only ends up benefiting the white supremacist power structure. We continue to be divided. That's exactly what white supremacy wants, because we don't have the collective power that we need. So as a Southerner, because I'm originally from Arkansas, generations of Southern folks, in my lineage, like I'm really sensitive to this. And, you know, I also want to name that, like, that deflection and that posturing has also taught me, and I think I'm not alone in this as someone from the South, to hide and be ashamed of parts of my whole self. So we have to be clear about who we're fighting. You know, in the biblical text, it's Egypt or it's Babylon or it's Rome. And for us, it's not our siblings next door. It's like Bezos and Amazon and Elon Musk and Walmart and Mitch McConnell and like those who are holding so tight to that white power structure.
So what advice would you give to someone? Let's say that there is a fundamental difference between you and your neighbor. Like you believe that all Black Lives Matter, and they have a Blue Lives Matter sign. They're not the enemy, right? Like they're it, what you're saying, you know, like there are the same people being marginalized. What advice do you give to people to bridge that gap, to work together for, you know, like how do we navigate that? Because I think that that is exactly what is happening in today's world. We have everybody is so polarized, heels dug in, doesn't want to talk, mad at each other, as opposed to looking at who we really could. You know what I'm saying? Like, yeah. I wonder what advice you have for that.
Yeah. Meanwhile, Bezos is raking in like gazillions of dollars, right? Yeah, and this is really hard, right? Because it hits us literally where we live with the people that we love and that we have to be in relationship with. And it's challenging. But one of the reasons that we did this Signposts in the Wilderness series during Lent is because as contributors, we were noticing that as white folks, as white organizers, that just writing off the folks that we disagree with and posturing ourselves as the good ones, the innocent ones who have it all figured out, which is what we love to do as white folks in the movement, like we're the right ones, you know, that's actually not working. It's not working to bring more people into the good work. And we were thinking about how abolitionists and transformative justice practitioners have been teaching us that no one is disposable. Like that's a key teaching in order to kind of break us out of policing and jailing mindsets. No one is disposable. Like, okay, so if no one is disposable, then how do we stay in relationship? How do we posture ourselves, if you will, differently? And, you know, we have a neighbor who is a homophobe and is not, you know, quiet about telling us that when he talks to us. He also plays his music really, really loud. Hopefully you can't hear it because he has been this afternoon. You know, so how do we, like, you know, I'm always talking about get to know your neighbors, like get to know your neighbors, talk to your neighbors, you know, so what do we do about that? Like, so we continue to talk to him and we don't call the cops on him when he plays his music loud. We just keep talking to him. And you know, and I've been thinking a lot about this, you know, with like the anti-vaxxers and then like seeing some folks on social media, you know, the good ones, the woke ones, quote unquote, who are like a little bit gleeful that anti-vaxxers are getting sick with COVID and dying, and that they're saying in some way or another, like, that's great, let them die. You know, sometimes I say that literally and sometimes a little more creatively, but that's kind of the idea. And I get like blowing off steam and like we're mad because this is creating like a very deep lack of safety for so many of us, especially our children. But I've really been wrestling with how I don't think that that kind of posturing actually helps. And so like, what if our response was, that's fine, we're going to keep loving you. We're going to keep working to make sure that everyone, including you, is as safe from this virus as we can. We're going to make sure everyone, including you, has food and healthcare and rent and whatever in order to survive this pandemic, which is kind of a dream because racial capitalism, white supremacy, they don't actually give a shit about that. I'm sorry, can I cuss on your podcast? Yeah, they don't give a shit about that. They actually don't want that. But in my dream world, that would be what we were doing. Like, I'm going to keep wearing my mask because I refuse to sacrifice your life. You are not disposable to me, even though your ideas are despicable to me and I do not understand them. I will not put your life at risk. And that's a response from like such a deep and difficult place of love. And
deep and difficult. That's deep and difficult. And it's so Jesus, like it's so the exact hard work that Jesus has called us to do, love your neighbor and your enemy. And, you know, and so it's just, but it's, even when you're saying that, I'm just like, wow, what a centered place I would have to be to really respond in that way. Because some of these issues are so important. They're so important to us. They're vulnerable for us.
And I want to add, like, obviously, you know, we want folks to have good boundaries from people who are like harmful, right? It's not about just anything goes, but, you know, our uncomfortableness does not necessarily mean that we're not safe. And so can we get to the fear that's under the fear that's animating what's happening right now with the misinformation, like the willful, like disinformation that folks are clinging onto in a time of immense uncertainty and stress, as these structures, like, you know, capitalism is falling apart, the climate, you know, even if we folks are trying to say, oh, it's, you know, science isn't real or whatever, like, also we know, like, deep down in our bodies, like, we know, you know, that something is really, really wrong, and we're scared. So how do we get to the, like, the fear that's under that fear, and, like, hold each other in that? And I don't know that I have, like, the best, greatest answers for that.
And that's where we have to continue, you know, because Jesus never stops being Jesus. And that's one of the things that we talked about too, or you talked about, and I think that's so powerful. And you name Malchus, you name, which I'd never heard. I was so that was a powerful moment as well, is naming your neighbor, like, yeah, loving the neighbor,
yeah,
through this moment. Naming your neighbor, it's a real valuable person. They're humans, and we need to love everyone. And so that was powerful.
Well, I didn't name Malchus. John names Malchus. And, right, you know, I didn't even really realize that he doesn't get named in the other three Gospels until John names him. You know, the Jewish annotated New Testament, which highly, 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 highly recommend to everyone. It's a fantastic resource. They've made the point in the note, like, oh, look, he has a name. I was like, oh, he has a name.
Right.
Why does he get named here? Like, why is that important? And then realizing that, like, so many, John is so particular about naming people. He names Malchus. He names Peter. Peter is not named as the one who slices off Malchus's ear. Malchus, for those who are listening who might not know, he's enslaved to Caiaphas, the high priest, and he's sent out with the cops and soldiers to arrest Jesus. Peter grabs somebody's sword and whacks off his ear, and Jesus is like, don't do that. That is not, Malchus is not the person we should be fighting here. This, none of this is Malchus's fault. Like, why are we blaming Malchus? Like, what are you doing? You know, and so he does. He, like, Jesus holds on to that core understanding of who he is and who he's supposed to be about. You know, he never, you know, tells on his friends. He doesn't tell Pilate where they are. He doesn't spill any of the beans about the movement. He's just like, you're going to do what you're going to do, and I'm going to keep being me. And, like, I don't know how he did that, but that kind of, you know, you said earlier, Chelsea, like, having to be super grounded in that moment. You know, he had to go into that incredibly prepared and hold on to that place in him, that divine, you know, connection and place in him, to be able to build, like, literally build community with his last breath when he sends the unnamed, actually, beloved disciple to Mary, his mother. It's like, now he's your son. Like, he's building community with his last breath. This is the last thing I'm going to do, is make sure my people have community.
I so appreciated that. We're at the collective table where we talk about community all the time. Like, we are not meant to do this work of reading scripture, of doing justice, of belonging to one another by ourselves. And I had never read that text that way, but that was really beautiful. Like, even in his last breath, he's pointing us to one another.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, you know, so Jesus-y.
Yeah.
Hey, and I know we're coming up on time. I have so many more notes, but I really think the best thing for people to do is listen to the sermon. And if they have questions and they, you know, other things we didn't ask, maybe we could do part two with you or something.
That'd be great. Yeah.
So here's my question I like to ask faith leaders.
Yeah.
What is your dream for the future of the church?
I want to live in a world where everyone is cherished and safe and has all they need to thrive. I want to live in a world where there's no cops, there's no papers to prove that you get to exist. There's no borders, there's no prisons, no military, nobody's profiting off of anybody's suffering. And, like, that's what I want for the church. And too often it has not been that. And we're seeing the impact of that with the decline of the church here in this country anyway. You know, I would love to see the church, like, give its land back to Indigenous people, all of this land that we have. I would love to see the church pay reparations. Northern Church, Southern Church, whoever, pay rent reparations. I'd actually love to see the dismantling of the church as an institution and just let it be the grassroots movement it was meant to be, where we are gathering for nourishment and to give praise to God and to remind ourselves why we're here and what it means to be human, and then to go and do that work in the world, you know, and let go of our buildings, let go of our endowments, and use those to build like centers for mutual aid and communal care while everything is crumbling around us. We could do that. That's what kind of what I see Jesus doing while the empire is crushing his people. Is like, how are we going to make sure everybody's fed? How are we going to make sure that people have access to healthcare? Because those are his two big things, right? It's like feeding people and healing people and getting them rerooted in their tradition, not a new tradition, but their own tradition with its deep, rich history of figuring out how to survive when the empire is trying to, you know, annihilate you.
You end your podcast by saying blessings to you and all that you do to resist injustice and all that you do to build up a new world. Mm-hmm. And I think you described that new world really beautifully. Yeah. And
that's Dr. Harding. That's Dr. Harding, his song, We Are Building Up a New World.
Yeah.
We are building up a new world. And so, you know, whatever we can do, he would say, you know, what is your brick? What is your brick that you're bringing to rebuild the world, to build up a whole new world? So this is part of your brick, this podcast.
I got to write that one down. Yeah. What's your brick? That's a good one.
Yeah.
Well, Anne, thank you so much for your time, for the work that you're doing with Surge and The Word is Resistance. We'll absolutely send people to the podcast and this sermon. But I have so much to process from this conversation, just as I had so much to process from this sermon. It really gave me that little energy push I need, you know, to continue. So thank you so much.
You're so welcome. And thank you for having me on. And yeah, if part two feels like it would be a great idea, I'm totally open to that. I think the more that we can have these conversations in whatever ways that we can do it, for me, it's also very deeply nourishing. So thank you also for the opportunity.
Thank you so much for joining us for this episode of the Collective Table Sermon Podcast Hour. May you find joy and peace in the small and large moments.
May you continue to encounter the mystery of a God ever present.
May you live into the grace that God has set before you.
May you remain open to the ever expansive love of our great God.